So this morning, what I want to talk about is mindfulness of breathing. Makes some sense after what I said at the beginning of the sitting. And partly because I wanted to really give a strong plug for something that's very practical in meditation practice. The mindfulness of breathing is considered phenomenally important in most of Buddhist practice. In the teachings of the Pali Suttas, the Buddha gives a kind of pride of place in various ways. One of the ways is that when the Buddha himself goes off on retreat, which he does periodically, you might wonder why a Buddha needs to go on retreat. But everyone does from time to time, so even a Buddha. And he was asked what... he said, if anyone asks what I'm doing when I'm on retreat, tell them that I'm practicing mindfulness of breathing. And down through the centuries, many Buddhist teachers have strongly encouraged people to practice mindfulness of breathing. And in some teachers will actually say that's the only practice you need to do, that everything else will come from that. It's such a significant and transformative practice just to follow the breath, just to be with the breath. The breath is a miraculous event, the breathing is. And I remember when I was about 20, I was living on a farm, small dairy farm. And somehow life was so harmonious. And so it was a lot of physical work. I was out in the fields a lot. I was talking to the cows a lot. At some point in the middle of that time, I felt that for the first time in my life, I discovered how to breathe. And it never occurred to me that I didn't breathe, that I didn't know how. But the experience of a life which was so settled allowed my breathing to become quite settled. And I felt this wonderful harmony in my body through my breathing, or my breathing expressed this harmony or this settledness or this peacefulness or lack of conflict. And I felt like I discovered how to breathe for the first time. And periodically, I watch my breath a lot in my practice, and I can watch how my relationship to my breath changes over the months and the years and over the days and even the hours, depending a lot on what my mood is, what my relationship to the world is, how much stress I have, how much ease I have. And there are times my breath feels quite profound, and other times where it feels like it's labored. I remember there's a story of Gurdjieff going to study with a Sufi teacher, and the Sufi teacher asked him why he was there. And Gurdjieff said, I'm here to learn how to breathe. And the Sufi teacher roared with laughter, thought that was it was the funniest thing he ever heard, and then spent the next many years teaching Gurdjieff how to breathe. So to learn how to breathe, those of us who... Oh, you have trouble hearing in the back? Oh, you should speak up. We're an informal group here. You're welcome to say something. Oh. I mean, but Gurdjieff's story? Oh, so Gurdjieff said that he was there to learn how to breathe. And the teacher laughed and laughed and laughed when he heard that, and then proceeded to spend the next few years and many years teaching Gurdjieff how to breathe. So what is it with the sound today? Is it too... There's an echo. It's kind of muffled. I hear something a little bit too. I'm kind of... What do you think that is today? The mystery of the sound speaker. Maybe if we move the position... Is my breathing? Let's see if that makes any difference. Does that make a difference? Is it the position of this, or he adjusted the knobs? You adjusted the knobs. So are we happy now? Everyone can hear? No echo? I have a natural voice now? Okay, so back to the breath. Breathe, everyone. So So, you know, the breathing is pretty miraculous, pretty amazing event. And, you know, before we look at it kind of in a meditative way, I'm inspired to when I look at it kind of more at the physiological level of and our interconnected level with the world around us. Maybe it happened to many of you, had these reflections. But when I was about 5 or 6, I remember my father, a common thing he would talk to me about, or kind of it was kind of like a game, would be talking about the exchange of molecules in the universe, and how, you know, he would say things like that in every breath of air that you breathe, there's molecules of breath that were breathed by Cleopatra and Julius Caesar, and you know, because there's so many molecules in each breath that, you know, then they get spread out so thoroughly that we're actually breathing in everyone else's breath that's ever lived before us. But he was particularly fond of talking about this when we went out in the woods to pee. And, you know, what we were peeing on. Somehow we were peeing, you know, as everything is, you know, the carbon and the grass that we're peeing on was probably, some of that carbon was one day, at one point or other, also in the body of beautiful Cleopatra, whatever. But the, you know, the wonderful way we're interconnected. And I've told this story many times, but my undergraduate degree is in agronomy, agriculture. And I took a lot of botany classes, and my graduate studies were all in religion. And I would say, in comparison to these two programs I was in, the most spiritual religious class I ever took was my introduction to botany. I was much more inspired in some deep spiritual way by that than anything I studied in graduate school in religion. And I remember in particular the learning there also about the exchange of the nutrients and how these, you know, the plants take in carbon dioxide and they transform it into oxygen, and then we breathe in the oxygen and we make carbon dioxide, and around it goes, around and around. And I remember, you know, I was kind of completely captivated by this botany class, and I guess I was very concentrated and absorbed in what I was being taught. And I remember one day leaving the classroom into the courtyard at the university where I was at, and just standing still and looking around the trees around the courtyard in utter utter awe. And the reflection I had was something like the, you know, I can do without a kidney, I can do without a hand, one of my eyes. There's a lot of things I could do without that I think are pretty important for me. I actually can do without. But I could not live without the existence of the plants. That somehow the existence of plants in the world are in some sense more important than some of these particular organs which I put so much store on in. And so then the reflection continued and say, well, if that's the case, where do I begin and where do I end? Where does the plants begin? Where do they end? And, you know, who am I in relationship to all this? And so my breath then became kind of another point of focus, because the breath was the place of this connection with these plants. I have this poem which speaks about this some. I thought I would try reading it. It's long, but hopefully I read it in a way that is interesting. And this poem is, I'm not sure who's speaking the poem, who the subject is, who the I is, but it can be understood to maybe be each of you. It can be understood to be the air that's everywhere. It can be maybe be understood to be the world. They told me, when I awoke to this body, each breath will taste my blood with the tongue of every creature who has lived. And I said yes. And the air I breathe will be torn by rocks, abraded by fans, and bruised in the factories of steel. And I said yes. And they said the ants have a right to this breath as much as I, and it erases their paths as they walk and as easily. It erases mine. They said my breath will read me from inside with its licking torch as if I were a cave, and I said yes. And the air will carry the breathless patience of stone and the seething heat of asphalt and scatter me from the memories of as flickeringly as footsteps. And I said yes. And the air will stir the wet of my body in the ocean of bodies and in shared bodies of hives and cities and in the poisons. And I said yes. I will breathe air that has passed through the nail holes punched by children into jar lids to save the lives of fireflies. And I say yes. I will breathe the force which blows windrows in snow and rubs waves in the sand and strips topsoil from farmlands and makes the cypress cringe from the sea. Though it is sour with dreams and loud with sickness, it will run beside my heart like a young girl beside a horse. It will forgive my legs for running and chase my mind away from its fear, and I say yes. I will blow into whirlwinds in the breath of my lover, and into sea storms I will fly to be healed. I will whisper through the perforated coinage of sewer lids. I will lie down in hot valleys with the breath of vegetables, and I will say yes. I will breathe a clear cloud of silk around my heart and wear a frayed scarf of fire. I will breathe what determines the path of falling feathers and boil the snow from the seared summits of mountains. I will stay trapped 1,000 years in a tomb until a mouse will free me. I will blow a cloud on the final mirror of the dying before the silence cracks. And I will make a quick slate for fingers shouting behind cold glass, breathing and saying yes. So the wonderful way in which the breath, the air, connects all things. I come down often from, I live up on Skyline, in a little apartment in the woods, and I often come down here and see all the smog, and descending into the smog, and once we're down here, we don't see it so much. We're not aware of what we're breathing. This is another poem titled Breathing by Mark O'Brien. Grasping for straws is easier. You can see the straws. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, presses down upon me at 15 pounds per square inch, a dense, heavy, blue, gluing ocean, supporting the weight of condors that swim its churning currents. All I get is a thin stream of it, a finger's width of the rope that ties me to life, as I labor like a stevedore to keep the connection. Water wouldn't be so circumspect. Water would crash in like a drunken sailor. But air is prissy and genteel, teasing me with its nearness and pervading immensity. The vast circumambient atmosphere allows me but 90 cubic centimeters of its billions of gallons and miles of sky. I inhale it anyway, knowing that it will hurt in the weary end of my crumpled paper bag lungs. So here's someone who has trouble breathing, probably some kind of illness of the lungs. And it's very hard to breathe, and he doesn't take it for granted. Some people who meditate find that if they have any memory of ever skin diving or scuba diving, that provides a wonderful association to help them kind of enter into the breathing more fully as they meditate. Because when you're scuba diving or skin diving, often the breath is so pronounced, you know, it's like, especially if you're scuba diving, it's like, they better be there. So the breath, you know, our breathing connects us to the world around us. It also connects us very intimately to the world within us. And I think of the breath as being one of the primary bridges to much of the immensity, much of the depth of our inner life. Carl Jung had this famous statement about dreams being the royal road to the unconscious. And my paraphrase of that, or my redoing of that, is that our body and the breath is the royal road to the unconscious. So much of our attitudes, conscious and unconscious, about our relationship to the world around us and to ourselves, manifests itself in how we breathe. The word anxiety, if you look up the etymology of the word, means to choke. You know, so the breath is constricted and you feel like you're choking. Many of our emotions are expressed in the way we breathe. And it makes some sense, because the breath is, if we can moderate how much breath air we get, we can moderate in some sense the amount of energy the system has. So when you're working really hard, you have to breathe harder to get more oxygen and thereby get more energy released in the system so you can do more work. And so if you're afraid, the body has to suddenly feels like it has to breathe more fully, maybe, perhaps, or we hold the breath sometimes when we're afraid, rather than in order to be really still and not to just to be maybe to be attentive and alert, or maybe so no one notices us, or I don't know why. We regulate much of our relationship to the world in part through how we breathe. People who want to control things a lot, to control themselves, to control the world, control their emotions, will often hold their breathing, because if they hold their breath, their emotions are held at bay sometimes. If you breathe fully and if you relax fully, then sometimes the held anger or grief or sadness or happiness or whatever, the laughter, will sometimes come tumbling out in times when we don't want it to come out. Maybe we don't want it ever to come out. And so sometimes we hold our breath. It gets locked and frozen. As we begin tuning into what our breathing feels like, feeling where it is in the body, how free it is, how constricted it is, where the tightness might be, how full it is or how shallow it is, that often becomes a window into experiencing our emotions, knowing what our relationship is to the world around us, what's happening to us. And for sometimes it's one of the primary kind of first steps into that kind of understanding and realization. And then that gives us an opportunity, perhaps, to change our breaths, to adjust it, to relax our breathing, to breathe more fully and more deeply, to let the breath become fluid again, if it's held. If we breathe consciously and mindfully, then I liken that to being the lubricant of our inner life. Because if the breath is really fluid and flowing, it's actually very hard to be frozen and locked in around our emotional life or our cognitive life, which many people are a lot of the time. And sometimes it's because of inner emotional reasons, and sometimes it's partly because of social reasons that our breath is held. We're sometimes trained by our society to breathe particular ways. I know that a lot of women were trained as young women, girls perhaps, to hold their stomach in. It was unwomanly, is that the right expression? To have your breath kind of hanging out. And so women will hold them often. How many of you had that experience? So, okay. So, and some, I know some women have trained themselves kind of unconsciously to hold it in for a lifetime. And I remember once meeting she was actually a retired, an ex-Catholic nun. She was in her 60s. And she'd become a therapist. She'd been most of her adult life in a convent. And the convent life had not helped her learn how to breathe better. Because she showed up at a meditation retreat I was teaching. And she explained to me during an interview that she had this uncontrollable need to yawn all the time, especially in meditation, but just a lot in her life. And so I thought that was curious. I didn't know what it was about. So I thought, Rob, we'll do a guided meditation on mindfulness of breathing together, and we'll see what might happen, or maybe maybe just show her how to breathe or something. So I asked her to close her eyes, and I just simply asked her to relax and to relax her stomach, as a prelude to what we were going to do. And as soon as I said, "You relax your stomach," she burst into tears. And she burst out something like, some expression like, "It's not okay to relax my stomach," or "It's unwomanly to do that," or something. And then she realized that she had internalized this message from her childhood and carried this stomach around quite tight for a whole lifetime. And had never released it, never relaxed it. And that this is what was making it difficult for her to get her full breath of air, and especially in meditation. So she had to yawn. Felt like she needed to yawn all the time in order to compensate. But it's also men who hold their stomachs in. I've had to deal with a lot of that myself. I spent years in my meditative life slowly training my stomach to be relaxed. It wasn't an active agenda so much, but I was certainly aware of the tension I held in my stomach. And usually at the beginning of every period of meditation, I'd relax my stomach. And for a long time, it would just, you know, that was very nice for a second, and then it would tighten up. And then slowly, as more trust and ease developed through my spiritual practice, the stomach has found itself more and more relaxed. And now, generally, it's pretty relaxed. And it's interesting, though, as I'm speaking, you know, I pay attention to this. And sometimes when I'm speaking, like giving a talk like this, I notice there are times when I hold my breath, I hold my stomach in. Sometimes because I have a long monologue to speak, you know, to get it out. But sometimes because I'm a little bit worried about what I said. Would that make sense? Do people hear it right? Do people like it? You know, a little kind of concern somehow. I feel, oh, you're a little tight. So I pay attention to that, because by paying attention to that, then that becomes a cue to me. It helps, one of the ways to helps me understand what's happening inside of me. And one of the easy ways of letting go of those kinds of concerns is to let go of the stomach, let the stomach become relaxed again. Generally, in mindfulness meditation, we talk about having leaving the breathing alone, to have a natural breath, not to have any kind of forced or manipulated breath. And there are lots of Buddhist traditions that actually emphasize having a particular kind of breath. I'll tell you another story that's going to be kind of tangential, but it's about this. So I went, I was practicing in a Rinzai monastery in Japan. I was sitting sesshin. It was a very tough, very traditional Rinzai monastery, if you know anything about Rinzai Zen. And it was so traditional that I had this feeling I'd stepped into the Middle Ages when I was there. It was just, you know, I couldn't believe things were going on. So I dutifully kind of went along with the program. And then about the third or fourth day, the head monk and a couple of the other kind of senior monks invited me into the private quarters of the head monk, together with another young monk in the monastery, a Japanese monk who had been there for a little while. I didn't know what it was about. It was the middle of this great, intense, silent retreat, and I was kind of called into the office kind of thing. And so I was standing there next to, me and this other monk were standing there next to each other, and the instructions were to strip. Take off your robes. So, okay. That's the program. And as soon as I did, took off my robes, they got all kind of embarrassed, because in the Soto Zen tradition I was in, you just have these robes, kind of. But in the Rinzai tradition, you wear a skirt, a slip under it. So I was just standing there in my underwear, and that they weren't expecting that far. they assumed I had the slip underneath, this white slip. So later they gave me a slip so that I would have a slip too. But here's, you know, so there I was standing, you know, just my undies. And this other young monk was standing there with his slip on. And the whole, what they wanted to do was they wanted the young monk to show me how to breathe properly. Because in that particular monastery, they had a very particular way, very forced way, very very kind of energetic way of breathing with the abdomen. And they wanted me to learn this particular way of breathing. So that's just an example of, you know, I don't want to teach you that particular way. It's quite kind of involved. Generally, in mindfulness practice, we say just, you know, breathe the way you're breathing and don't worry about it. There's no right or wrong way of breathing. The point of mindfulness practice is primarily just to develop your mindfulness on the breath, develop the strength of paying attention, and we just use it, the breath as a convenient place to do that. However, to some small degree, it's useful to spend a little bit of time monitoring your breath at the beginning of a period of meditation or beginning of a period of a meditative career, and just spend a little bit of time just kind of exploring the breath, finding out what it's like, how you breathe. And if you can do it without too much complication, without getting anxious, to see if there's some simple ways you can adjust the breath in your meditation. Can you relax your stomach and have a more easeful breath? Can you sit up straighter so that your chest is more open and you breathe more freely in your lungs? Because some people, when they slump over, even just a little bit in a meditation, it actually constricts the breathing and makes it more difficult to breathe. And you're actually more comfortable and more open. The breath kind of supports us in more ways than one when our posture is more upright and we're breathing more freely. Sometimes you might also take some time to have some longer, deeper, slower breaths. Breathing fully into the torso, into the chest, into the rib cages, into the stomach, up into the shoulder blades and the collarbones and the shoulders. And really long, deep, full breaths, primarily to see if you can notice where there might be some constriction or some holding in the breath, some tightness. And then if it's possible, sometimes to breathe into that, it can maybe helps you relax or let go of it, especially as you breathe out. If you breathe into tension in your torso on the in-breath, and then on the out-breath kind of let go, sometimes you can let go of some of that tension. Or sometimes you can make some small adjustment to make the breath a little bit more comfortable. And the more comfortable the breath is, the more appealing it is for a place for our attention to rest. But even having said that, I should warn you that it's not so easy to do that, and you don't want to get in the trap of spending a lot of time trying to find the perfect, right, comfortable breath. But just a little bit, I mean, teeny bit of that is okay. Remembering that in mindfulness, we primarily don't do anything special with the breath at all. We just pay attention to it. There's no wrong breath. Sometimes it's actually wiser not to try to adjust it, but just kind of be really present for the breath that you have and let mindfulness do whatever work it's going to do. Don't you try to manipulate and change it. And of course, one of the interesting ways of being aware of the breath is to be aware that you are manipulating it. Some people control their breath a lot, and then they come to me and they say, you know, I'm controlling it as if they shouldn't be. This is bad, you know, you're supposed to have a natural breath. From the point of view of mindfulness practice, you don't actually need to stop controlling the breath. All you need to do is notice you're controlling it. Because mindfulness is about noticing, it's not about, you know, changing what you notice. It's strengthening your ability to see. So it's fine, just become the world-class expert in what a controlled breath feels like. It's, you know, just study it and get to know it, and eventually it'll change. All these things change. And if you're more relaxed, you are about having a controlled breath, the quicker it'll change. One of the important functions of mindfulness of breathing is that it's an alternative place for the mind to go than our usual preoccupations. Many of us are very easily drawn into our thoughts, our memories, our planning, our all kinds of concerns in our story-making minds. And it's like the default. It's a place we kind of just automatically go, or maybe we never left it. You know, that's where we are. And the breath is not a story. The breath is not an idea. It's not a memory. It's not planning for the future. The breath is something very simple, concrete, tangible, in the present moment. And it's a wonderful alternative to our preoccupations. And to entrust ourselves to the breathing, to bring ourselves fully into the breath, slowly begins to loosen the strength of our preoccupations, the compulsions we have to be concerned about different things. And it isn't that being concerned about things is bad. What we hopefully want to do is to be free of compulsion around things. Free to drop it when we don't necessarily need it anymore, or when we want to do something else. And maybe find some deeper peace than being kind of lost in our compulsions and our thoughts. So the breath, to bring our attention to the breath over and over again, is a wonderful alternative. It trains the mind, or offers the mind an alternative to preoccupation. And it's not so easy, of course, because you go to the breath and often the mind will pop right back to its concerns. But every time you come back to your breathing, or every time you're willing, even to willing to let go of your preoccupations even just kind of for a fraction of a second, in order to attend to the breath. You're weakening your preoccupations and strengthening the power of your mind to apply itself on where it wants to go, to choose where it wants to pay attention to, as opposed to having a choice made for it by the distracted mind. And it might seem insignificant to you that you come only for a second back to the breath before the mind gets pulled quickly to a concern. But every time you come back to the breath is significant. It's kind of like, you know, with enough drops, the bathtub gets filled. Or maybe it feels more like with enough drops, the ocean will get filled. But sure enough, it'll get filled. And each drop is quite significant. And our life has often been created. Our current life and our concerns and preoccupations and anxieties and all that has often been created drop by drop in the other way. You know, every drop of preoccupation, you know, fills up the ocean of preoccupation. It's had a lot of chance. Every time we come back to the breathing, then we get the chance to, to retrain the mind. And fortunately, it happens relatively fast. It doesn't feel that way, but the filling of the bathtub of our spiritual life happens relatively fast. And in coming back to the breath, something so simple as the breath, matter-of-factly, easily, without trying to manipulate or control the breath, just coming back to the breath, is a wonderful gift to ourselves because it's a way of leaving ourselves alone. Many of us don't leave ourselves alone because we're critical of ourselves, we're concerned about manipulating ourselves or making ourselves into something better or doing, you know, judging or, you know, there's many things that we, complicated ways in which we relate to ourselves. And those relationships often happen through our involvement with our ideas and stories and values and things like that, all of which require some involvement with story making and thoughts. To come back and rest the attention on the breath, and to rest it there and rest it there and rest it there, is a phenomenally effective way of beginning to leave ourselves alone and not to always be on top of ourselves, not always be harassing ourselves. Which is what many of us do to ourselves. And so many of us, we harass ourselves in various ways, and then we harass ourselves even more for harassing ourselves. Or our very attempts to try to fix it is in the realm of the problem itself. And so we're so preoccupied and concerned about something, and then we try to fix it by getting more preoccupied about that. And sometimes our efforts to kind of get some peace are self-defeating. And that's why something as simple as the breath is so powerful, because when we're really with the breath, there's no story making, and we left ourselves alone. And one of the things that begins happening then, when we start leaving ourselves alone, is the momentum of our preoccupations, the momentum of our involvement with different things in our life, our feelings, our emotions, our attachments, our compulsions, our tensions, our stresses, they have a chance to begin to unwind, to relax. But if we stay preoccupied, then the preoccupation will just keep adding to that little piece of that stress, will hold the stress kind of locked in there, wherever it might be. But if we can begin getting out of the way, leaving ourselves alone, then the momentum will begin unwinding. And slowly, slowly, you'll find yourself unraveling. The tensions will unravel, your concerns will begin quieting down on their own. And it's a really beautiful thing. It's one of the reasons why mindfulness of breathing is so tends to produce calm in people, is that we begin to leave ourselves alone. But if you understand that principle, that we're trying to leave ourselves alone when we attend to the breath, maybe it's easier then to be dedicated to attending to the breath. Oh, this is what I'm doing here. I'm learning how to be compassionately leave myself alone and just hang out with the breath. Our party, our political party, is that of compassionate respiration. As we do this work of just attending to the breath carefully and mindfully, then certain understandings begin developing, and some of the understandings is we see some of the connections between our breathing and our inner life, our emotional and cognitive life, and that's valuable to see that. And slowly, as we tend to the breath and let the breath release itself and release the holdings in the body, the breath can feel phenomenally healing. I was really surprised when I first discovered the tremendous healing qualities of meditation that often kind of radiated out from the breathing. The sense and the feeling of there being, I don't like using this kind of language very often, but I'm a little bit short of words, kind of a healing energy kind of coursing through the body. It's almost like the blood is carrying with you. You kind of feel almost sometimes this whole kind of flowing, vibratory, healing sense throughout the body that can come with developed meditation practice. One of the functions of mindfulness of breathing is to develop concentration. And the concentration comes from being able to sustain the attention on the breath over time. So it's one thing to bring the attention to the breath and keep it there for a second, and the mind gets carried away again. But it's another whole thing to be able to then bring the attention to the breath, and then very gently and firmly sustain the attention on the breath over time, so that you're there for each in-breath and each out-breath. You're there for the rhythm of the breath, you're kind of flowing with the rhythm. And you stay in touch with that rhythm. You kind of stay in touch and you don't leave it. You kind of hang there with it. You are very sensitive to what part of the cycle of breath where it thinks your connection to the breath might be vague or very tenuous. And then you want to kind of just remind yourself, just hang in there during the tenuous part of the cycle. For many people, it's the end of the out-breath where they feel that kind of things get kind of vague. And if the part of the cycle of breath gets vague, and if the mind needs to do something, an idle mind gets in trouble. So if the mind is trying to follow the breath, and you're there with the in-breath, and you're there for the beginning of the out-breath, and then the out-breath kind of gets really faint, and the mind is not really filling the mind, the attention, very well, then the mind's going to choose to do something else. Gets into trouble. Goes off in some kind of thought. But if you can know there's a pattern of faintness in the breath where you tend to wander away, then you can encourage yourself to stay there through the whole cycle and actually kind of have a little reminder during that point in the cycle, oh, I'm going to stay here for it, just to get through it until it gets clearer again, the experience of breathing. People who are novices to mindfulness of breathing and novices to meditation, the breath seems very can seem like a very simple experience, and like there isn't much to notice there, just kind of like this little movement, pow, pow, pow. I've known people who've look for the breathing in meditation and can't find it. They aren't even aware of breathing. But as practice develops, I think you'll find that the breath becomes more and more alive and more a wider range of experiences and a wider kind of a more fuller connection to the breath gets developed. So talking about sustaining attention through the whole in-breath and the whole out-breath makes some sense as you get into it. At first, it might just seem that you're just aware for, a fraction of in breathing in, breathing out, and that's it. So part of the function of mindfulness of breathing is to develop concentration on the breath, to hang there. And concentration is a little bit like a muscle. And it's kind of like you're developing that muscle to become strong. And the stronger that muscle gets, the greater freedom you have of choosing not to get caught up in preoccupations and whatever they might be. And if you have a strong muscle of concentration, you can say, okay, forget that for the time being. I'm going to apply myself to my breath or apply myself to something else. And sometimes that's a very wise thing to do. There are times when our preoccupations don't give us a very good view of what's actually going on. If we're completely consumed with anger, consumed with desire or confusion. And we try to deal with our real life situations through the filter of our anger or desires or ambitions or confusions. We don't really see things very clearly. We don't see ourselves very clearly. We don't often see the anger or the desire very clearly itself. So if you can kind of turn ourselves back to the breathing for a while, for 5 or 10 minutes, and just be dedicated to breath for a while, and if you have some strength of concentration to do that, then you can very quickly change your perspective on the situation. And it's kind of like you take off your glasses of anger, or take off your glasses of frustration, and then you see the situation a lot differently. So a strength of concentration is a very useful thing to develop in many ways. For classic mindfulness practice, concentration is a very important element, because you can't really develop the deep levels of insight that mindfulness is pointing to unless you have the ability to get concentrated. And one of the places then to develop that concentration is on the breath. So I call the breath the wonderful lubricator of the day. And to spend, you know, it's wonderful. You come to a stop sign or a stoplight, and you have to wait, or any times during the day where you have to wait for something, and is a good time to check in with your breathing and see what's going on. And you might be surprised what you discover. You might just be described how often you're tense, and the breath will show that very quickly, and how things can change very quickly if you just follow the breath for 4 or 5 cycles, and maybe relax the tension a little bit and just be with your breathing. This is a poem that I used to read a lot. Some of you have heard it before. It's written by a woman, but it's in the voice of a man. In my room at last, I'm finally free to sleep my sleep and dream my own dreams beside your mom, who grows bigger each night with the new child getting ready to come into our lives. And I fear with 2 babes in the house, I'll have no time at all for me. How will I sleep the sleep I need to be alert in my office every morning, or be free to walk the solitary paths I love, or find the time to think my thoughts with 2 like you crying in the night, asking for water, bears, and who knows what else? What will I do then? What will I do? Just breathe in and out and watch my breath go out and in, they say. The teacher Thich Nhat Hanh tells the tale of another father chasing down time enough to satisfy a rowdy son, newborn daughter, wife, and self. The father meditates on breath and finds some way to make the time his children take his own time too. He gently twists and bends the hard dividing line between my afternoon, your morning, between work time, play time, between your time and my time for all the things to do. He relaxes the boundaries between me and you. That father stakes a claim to the days and hours he spends on baby baths and bottles, games, and tears and grins, even midnight diaper changes as his time too. So he finds he now has endless time. Will I be able to do that as well? Only time and breath will tell. And maybe like these people, you might find that the breath is a very quick and easy way of changing your life dramatically, if you want it to be changed. And that's a big if, right? Because many of us would rather, in the midst of our compulsions and preoccupations, it certainly looks like what's really operating is we want to be preoccupied and uptight and holding on to all kinds of things. That's looks like we really want to, doesn't it? But if you don't, if you want to develop more peace and ease and calm in your life, and more freedom and more capacity to meet the life that you live in an open-hearted way, mindfulness of breathing is one of the great practices you can practice. Look for opportunities to practice it. I know some Buddhist meditators who develop attention to the breath as a foundation of their attention all the time. They're regular, all the time connected. It's like they're paying attention to two things at once, their breath and whatever else they're doing in their life. The breath is very, very powerful and effective, kind of ground and anchor for our lives. The benefits of it just keep growing the longer you do it. So I encourage you to entrust yourselves in your breathing. Maybe if you haven't done this in your meditation so far, maybe take a serious chunk of time, a month or 3 months or whatever, and only practice mindfulness of breathing. Don't do anything else but just that, as a way of really getting in there and really get stabilized and settled on the breath. It's a very, very helpful thing to do. So maybe that's enough. I'll read one more poem, if I may. If you have time to chatter, read books. If you have time to read, walk into mountain, desert, and ocean. If you have time to walk, sing songs and dance. If you have time to dance, sit quietly and breathe, you happy, lucky idiot. If you have time to dance, sit quietly and breathe, you happy, lucky idiot. So, thank you all very much.